This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. From 1993 to 2011, more than 3,000 students at UNC Chapel Hill took classes that did not require them to show up. They were told only to submit a final paper, and they received inflated grades. Nearly half were student athletes who benefited from the classes by remaining eligible to play. Those are the findings from former federal prosecutor Kenneth Weinstein, who'd been commissioned by the university to investigate academic fraud. The report points much of the blame to two former employees at the university, Deborah Crowder and Julius Nangoro, but at least four others have been fired. Here to sort out the evidence of academic fraud and its relationship to athletics is Jack Stripling. He's a senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Jack, welcome to the State of Things.
Thanks for having me.
The story really does highlight some of the criticisms of the way big-time sports influence a university's academic record. This story actually began as an NCAA investigation into improper payments to a UNC football player, and then it opened into this academic scandal. So remind us how this all started.
Well, yeah, you're right. I mean, this goes back about 4 years, and the NCAA investigation is what started this, looking at things like improper benefits to players, receiving things, money and things they weren't supposed to get. And then as folks dug deeper, they started to see the beginnings of what became an incredibly expansive academic fraud scandal that, you know, really was along the way. More and more evidence came to light because of good reporting, frankly, in your state, as well as athletes coming forward and telling their stories, former athletes talking about what they did.
So in this report, the focus of attention really is primarily on two individuals. You have the president of the UNC system, Tom Ross, saying, quote, "The Crowder-Nangoro scheme marks a horrible chapter in the history of a great university." And then the investigator, Kenneth Weinstein, creates the narrative in his summary report. And he tells the story of why former administrator Deborah Crowder and the former chair of the African American Studies Department, Julius Nangoro, may have set up the no-show classes.
She had a somewhat unhappy experience here because she felt that the school paid too much attention to who she considered the best and the brightest students, the ones who didn't have troubles, and didn't pay enough attention to supporting those who did or who fell adrift. And she felt herself in that category. Chairman Nangoro shared some of her compassion and sympathy for students who were troubled. And in particular, as he told us, he felt particular compassion for student athletes. And that was because he'd had a couple student athletes early on in his career who were students. Both of them ended up having to leave the school because of ineligibility, and one of them ended up in jail and one ended up being murdered.
So, Jack, this very much is a story that centers around two personalities who are no longer at the university, and the university is very quick to sort of suggest that they're gone now, and so is this story. How much of this does revolve around two individuals, and does it go beyond this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point. Obviously, appropriately, a lot of focus is going on Deborah Crowder and Julius Nangoro. They really were the ones who orchestrated this, and I think Crowder in particular, bears a lot of responsibility for this. I do think it is a real misnomer, however, to chalk this up as the work of a couple individuals who were just rogues. That's an easy story, and it's a more attractive story. The facts as laid out by this report, if we're to believe it, show that this was incredibly widespread, and that over nearly two decades, you had people at all levels of the institution with some level of knowledge about this, and they either knew about it and didn't care, or they failed to ask tough questions about things that should have been very clear red flags.
Now, how do we know that? Tell us about that. In other words, how did the athletic department, for instance, take advantage of these classes?
Well, I think probably the most shocking thing in the report, which is 136 pages, to me, goes back to a presentation that athletics advisors gave to coaches in the football program. I think this was around 2009. And they were just mortified that Deborah Crowder was going to retire. Again, Ms. Crowder had been the one, she was basically a secretary, and she had been the one who was orchestrating this scheme. And the advisors were warning the coaches, you know, the golden goose is cooked. We're about to lose the woman who has single-handedly created these no-show classes, which are crucial to our strategy of keeping athletes eligible. And Weinstein, the investigator, got a hold of this PowerPoint slide where they say, you know, we're no longer going to have these classes where students don't have to attend, where they don't have to even stay awake. And what are we going to do? And that turns into, you know, what really becomes a more conspiratorial aspect of the story, which is advisors now trying to get Nyengaro to pick up where Crowder left off, to offer the same sham classes now that she's gone. So again, I mean, to say that these were just two individuals who did this, I think really underestimates the level of the problem.
And given the widespread participation at so many levels of the university, the question is sort of how did it go on for 18 years undetected? Carol Fold had an answer for that yesterday.
People have immense respect for faculty in a university system. And that goes faculty for each other, but that also goes for staff and it goes for coaches. And when faculty say that they're teaching a course, the absolute expectation is that they are teaching the course. And I think it's not surprising that people would not doubt that.
Carol Folt, the chancellor at UNC Chapel Hill. Jack Stripling, you cover this at the Chronicle of Higher Education. You've seen what other universities are doing. I mean, there have to be accountability standards even when you trust, you know, employees. How does something like this go on for 18 years with so many people creating PowerPoint presentations about it and not somehow get to the administration?
Yeah, I mean, I think Dr. Folt is absolutely right that part of this story is about a culture of deference for faculty members, and that we hire people who are qualified and we have some level of expectation that they're going to be honest. And I think, as Weinstein pointed out, that feeling is even more pronounced at a place as prestigious as Chapel Hill. The problem that I have with it, however, is that I think it really underestimates the level of knowledge that others might have had who weren't just looking the other way and thinking that everything was going right in this department. There were conversations that were had at the dean level with Professor Nyengaro about why do you have 300 independent studies you're offering in a given year? I mean, that's an absurd number for an individual professor to be offering. And all that Nyengaro had to do in order to satisfy this dean was to lessen the number a little bit. There was never a question about how you could possibly offer independent studies of any level of academic integrity at that scale. And so, again, this isn't just about deference. This is about, if this story is true, as conveyed in the report, this is about something more willful, a willful neglect.
Talking with Jack Stripling, senior reporter at the Chronicle of Higher Education, today on The State of Things. So it was an exhaustive investigation. We were told that over and over yesterday at the presentation. Is this the end of it for UNC Chapel Hill?
Well, we've seen that movie before, right? I mean, this has been going on for 4 years. I can't count the number of investigations that have happened. At every turn, we've been told by people at Chapel Hill that this was the end, and we've seen a lot of sequels. So I'm not ready to say that. And from a national perspective, if you look at things like what happened at Penn State after the Sandusky scandal, you had sort of the same situation. You had Louis Freeh came in and gave a very exhaustive report that was very compelling. And now folks are still nitpicking over the veracity of that. So this is a longstanding debate. You know, you've got the NCAA is still conducting its own work. That could lead to more sanctions. That's going to bubble up. If the folks, I mean, Carol Folt hasn't identified the people who are under disciplinary review, but assuming tenured faculty members are involved, that's a whole other process that will play out long and painful unless the professor agrees just to step aside. So I think there's a lot more to chew on here, and I think nationally the reform conversation is just beginning. I mean, how do we possibly oversee intercollegiate athletics in a way that it's remotely compatible with the academic mission of a major research institution? I don't think the answer is in this report.
Well, and you do cover this at the national level, and I wonder what the message is to other universities who are all clearly implicated in this and clearly, I would have to say, nervous about this report and the NCAA reporting the investigations that go on. What is the lesson here? Learn to cover up better, or is there a real reform movement that's going on?
I hope that's not the lesson, and I'm sure you do too. I think that people will take a hard look at how their advising offices are structured. One of the things that happened at Chapel Hill that I think was symptomatic of this problem was that there was this dual reporting line for academic advisors. They reported, you know, to an academic official, but had a dual line to an athletics official. And I think that that may have contributed to this issue. Now, I mean, I will tell you that from talking to advisors, having a reporting line to a provost or somebody in academics does not necessarily mean that you're not influenced by coaches who want to keep players eligible. Quite the contrary. I mean, these folks work within the belly of the athletic enterprise, and they're very much influenced by it. And these folks often have their salaries paid by athletics. So there's all sorts of conflicts of interest that, quite frankly, you know, higher education has been struggling with for decades. You know, we can go back to cases in Minnesota in the late 90s where this same hullabaloo blew up and everybody said, we're going to restructure our offices, we're going to really, you know, tighten the ship. And, you know, here we see all these years later the same sort of thing, but on a grander scale. It's actually pretty distressing.
All right, Jack. Well, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Jack Stripling is senior writer for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Just ahead, the third edition of the State of Things Issues Table. We're going to talk about education in North Carolina and how it is working into this year's elections. You'll hear that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us.